You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food and drink. I'm Stefan Gates, I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. In this episode, we're investigating the history of a drink that we first started drinking here in the UK in the early 17th century. It's gin, and it went in and out of fashion for a few years until the gin craze years of 1695 to 1735, when thousands of gin shops sprang up throughout England. It became synonymous in some ways with Englishness. It was seen as a Protestant drink as opposed to French brandy with its dirty taxes. But its history started in continental Europe, and it's now a very international drink. Over the last 10 years, gin has had an artisan resurgence, but is that still the case right now, and what does the future hold for the drink? But before we look at the future, let's rewind a few hundred years, because things were very different. Gin was notorious. Mother's Ruin was the name given to the cheap spirit blamed for social decline and the ill health of the masses. To explore its invention and today's vibrant gin culture, I'm joined by Johan Wester, head distiller at Hernö Gin Distillery in Sweden. Hernö was founded in 2011, I believe, was Sweden's first dedicated gin distillery. 2013, it was entered into its first awards, and it went on to become the most awarded gin in Europe. Hello, Johan, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Stefan. Thank you very much.
Okay, so just a little bit about you. Why gin? Why have you made gin your life?
Well, as many things in life, I suppose, I stumbled into this, really. I live in the city of Härnösand, a small town in the northern part of Sweden, and I have for many years I had an interest in flavors and taste experience and drinks for sure. And then I saw this gin distillery starting just outside of town in the village of Dala, a very small village, four households here in Dala.
that is a small village. Wow.
It's a really small village, yeah. Yeah. obviously, I followed the development of the distillery close by. Didn't at the time have any idea of starting working with it or anything like that. But I was working with one of the co-founders on my day job and eventually got asked if I wanted to help out at the distillery, hosting some tastings, doing some events, and sounded like a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So I jumped on that ship, and quite quickly, Jon, who is our founder, asked if I wanted to come over full time to the distillery. And here I am. Few years later.
It's fantastic. I love, and it's also quite fantastic that how sort of slightly random that is as well. I love that. I think that's the way that life should take you. Okay, so let's look at gin itself. In terms of the absolute basics, what is it? What defines a liquid as being gin?
So first off, we need a base alcohol, obviously. The base alcohol of gin should come from agricultural origin and should be distilled up to 96% ABV, mm-hmm. Meaning it's rectified and should carry no flavor itself apart from the base it comes from. In our case, we use a wheat base, which is very common in the gin industry, but you would be allowed to use a rye or a potato or other things as well.
And in terms of flavor, that's completely neutral.
Well, yeah, the name is grain neutral spirit, but tasting different grain neutral spirits, there for sure is a slight difference in between them.
Yeah.
So it's not neutral per se, but it is... almost neutral, but it's slightly different.
But you're the expert here. You're the distiller. You would notice. Would I notice the difference between those base grains, or is that really something that's very specialist?
In some cases, I mean, if I would serve you five or six different grain neutral spirits, diluted probably, because we wouldn't want to be drinking it at 96. it's not nice at all. I think you would notice. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
But then later on in a gin, it's harder, obviously, to find it.
Yes. Absolutely. So we've got our base neutral spirit, and then what?
Then the predominant taste of gin should come from juniper. So juniper is the basis of the flavor profile. Other than that, there aren't really any restrictions in what flavors or what direction you want to take it. So it's a very open definition. A grain neutral spirit, juniper predominant, and a minimum of 37.5% ABV in the final product, which gives a wide variety of gins out there, which is also one of the charms to me with gin.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, for any aliens listening to this podcast from outer space who don't have a frame of reference here, just give us what's the difference between gin and vodka?
So in the case of gin, it has to be flavored and flavored with juniper predominance. Whilst vodka is an unflavored, traditionally, we'll just see flavored vodka as well, but traditionally an unflavored alcohol. Yet again, not neutral because it carries flavors and aromas, but not flavored.
So in a sense, you could almost say that gin can potentially be vodka as its base with something beyond that as well.
Yeah, for sure.
If you added juniper to vodka, that's essentially a gin.
Yes, basically, yeah. Yeah, okay. And looking at here in Sweden, we have the tradition of schnapps or Scandinavian vodka or whatever you would call it. In Sweden, we would say brännvin, which is literally translates into burnt wine. So we have many different varieties of flavored alcohols here in Sweden. So it suits very well into that, even though we don't have the gin history here in Sweden in the same way.
And just back to, before we delve into the history bit, just one last question. For you as a distiller, what are the challenges of your work? Are you constantly trying to play with flavors, explore different things, or is it about balance and keeping a very, very regular sort of flavor reference?
I think you point out a couple of very interesting parts there. Obviously, at stages, we have to develop new things and play with flavors. And looking at how the market is working today, everyone keeps asking us, what's the next thing? What's coming up now?
Yeah.
We can't launch products every other week because the market is already quite saturated.
Absolutely, yeah.
But we have to stay on top on things and be ready to introduce new products every now and then, mostly through limited releases. Keeping the balance, for sure, that's what makes a great product. Day to day, it's all about doing the same product over and over and keeping the consistency while growing the company, while growing the volumes. I think that's not only our challenge, but really the challenge of all of the smaller distilleries popping up over the last years.
And is consistency difficult for a distiller? Are you constantly going, oh no, it's not quite right, we've got to come back to the original, and you're constantly trying to balance things? Or once you've got your formula, is it actually relatively simple to keep it consistent?
It's by no means rocket science, but we stumble upon things, so the botanicals can be different from year to year, but depending on the harvest. I mean, looking into wine, you would always talk about the vintage year, and you don't see that really in gin, even if you see it in some cases in a little bit, but for sure the juniper will be different this year than it is next year. So, I mean, yeah.
And what's the tool for deciding that? Is that a gas chromatography or is that your nose?
That's all by sensory and nose and the tastes.
Yeah.
We don't have any advanced tools, instruments to keep track of that.
Which I love to hear, to be honest. Okay, so now we've got the picture of what gin is and how it works. Let's delve into a little bit of the history. So often when we talk about the history of foods and drinks, we start with sort of ancient Egypt or Aztec times. But with gin, it's a much more modern substance, isn't it?
Yeah, we start in Holland with the Dutch. They started developing for medicinal purposes from the beginning, as with many spirits. And that you have all of these botanicals, which is the basis, again, for gin, juniper being the predominant one, which has been said during history to have different medicinal advantages to be working with. And the alcohol itself also plays a huge part in looking at that as a medicine.
Why juniper? Why was juniper such an important ingredient?
Yet again, it's all about the medicinal parts we're looking at. Also, it's a very interesting flavor giver, looking at it today. For sure, it's very rich in these oils. Mm. But you used it for anything from colds and coughs to potency. So it's a wide variety of medicinal use in juniper.
Okay. And so it started in Holland, which I think for lots of British people, they would be coughing into their gin to hear that it's not actually English, because we identify so much with it. But then it became, it's thought that Dutch soldiers drank gin. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. The invention of gin, if you like, or to start with distilling juniper berries and creating an alcoholic drink, that dates back to the middle of the 16th century. And then it was during the 30 Years War, while the British were fighting Spain. They were staying in Holland. They noticed the Dutch were drinking Genever. Genever meaning juniper. And also, obviously, looking into gin, and it's an abbreviation of Genever. So there we go again with the definition of it and the juniper basis. They were talking about the Dutch courage. The Dutch were drinking Genever before going into battle, and they got a bit more cocky.
Which is the definition of drinking gin. Okay, let's pause the history very, very briefly, because I've got a couple of gins here. I've got a Sipsmith, I've got a Japanese Roku gin, and I've also got a low alcohol, Clean Company, Clean G it's called. And can you guide me through how to taste gin?
So when I grab a new gin for the first time, I usually start by pouring it at room temperature in a nosing glass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So I'll do that. Let's. That was a good sound. Okay. I've got a little bit of Sipsmith. It is at room temperature. It's been straight from the my drinks cupboard, and just a little splash.
Yeah, a little splash. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fine. You can always top it off later, right?
It's going to be a good day. Just for anyone listening, we are recording this at 10:17 a.m. and I'm starting the day with gin. Okay, so I've got a splash in my glass, and how should I taste it?
So first off, I usually start by nosing it, because there are so many aromas to be found there. And if you go deeper into the glass, you will find the heavier aromas. You will find the juniper. You will find some of the underlying notes that you can probably find in there.
And so I mean, it's incredibly complex.
Yes.
And because of the ethanol, it just all flies straight at you to begin with.
Yeah.
And so you have to sort of try and calm yourself down a little bit and go, okay, what am I actually getting there? And the override sort of sense is that slightly resinous juniper sense, which is what I love about gin. Yeah. I mean, I love a gin and tonic.
And I think Sipsmith is a great example of, in that sense, a classic profile where the juniper really takes a large portion of nose.
Yeah. And then there's sort of citrusy elements. I mean, there's also, you know, the complexity of chocolate and all those multiple layers and the sort of the nuttiness, caramelness. So there is. I don't know if I'm just throwing words at this rather than actually thinking it, but there does seem to be that sort of chocolate complexity. So, you know, a flavour that works on so many different levels.
Yeah.
Okay. Now and then a little sip.
And then a little sip. Slightly after the first sip, I think it's a good time to take another sip, just to really let the palate accommodate all of those flavors coming in.
Yeah,
because it can be slightly overwhelming at first for the palate.
Yeah, and it smarts. You know, there's that whiskey heat and tingle, but it's much cleaner. And then you've got your retronasal olfaction going on, and suddenly everything begins to spread. But there is that. Do you know what? The overriding sensation is not so much taste, but happiness.
and that is what gin should be about, isn't it?
absolutely. But just that sensation. I mean, that's why it's such a beguiling and, you know, dangerous tool as well, because it literally just lights up your all of your senses. Oh gosh, I'm waxing lyrical now. Right, let's put that one down. So that's Sipsmith. Roku. Let's have a little taste of Roku.
Yeah.
The Japanese making gin. You see, they're so good at taking things over.
Yeah, and the Japanese has been coming on a lot lately. You're seeing more and more.
Okay, so this is the Roku. A lot more subtle, I would say, and slightly sort of more citrusy notes, maybe.
But as I remember it, it is quite less unipery forward and quite more herbal and floral.
Yeah, and so slightly peppery, but a lot gentler, less, to be honest, less ginny.
I think I get what you're saying, because of it's being a bit more toned down on the juniper.
And if juniper is the key thing, the less of it you have, the less gin you're gonna feel, I guess. Okay, I'm just gonna rinse out the old mouth.
Yeah.
And then, which I should have done this one first, really, but now let's talk about low-alcohol gin, just very briefly. What are your views on low-alcohol gin?
Getting back to the definition, gin should be at minimum 37.5% ABV. So anything less than 37.5 is not, by definition, gin.
Yeah, it doesn't add, I mean, to give them their credit, it doesn't say gin anywhere on the label. It just looks very clearly like it ought to be gin.
Yeah. And that's common. And it's not wrong to not be wanting to drink alcohol all the time, obviously. So I don't have an opinion on that, as long as, which they correctly do not do here, call it gin when it isn't gin. But I think...
Yeah. Kidding yourself with gin. Okay, so let's go in for a little taste of this. Okay, so obviously you don't get that rush of flavors because there's no ethanol to make it fly up your nose, but there's slightly disinfectant like. maybe that's the sort of resin, the pininess of juniper. It's more pine than juniper, I would have said, but nice actually. Okay, let's have a little taste. Oh, and so the taste is very different. So it's very fruity, sweet. I mean, obviously, it doesn't warm your palate up in anything like the same way. But you know what? That's an interesting taste journey. That it's very floral. It's very resinous, piney. You know, you could be wandering through a French pine woods near the seafront kind of thing. And I enjoy playing with different flavors and things like that. So that's a decent drink. And I have had this before with a bit of tonic, but only a little bit because the tonic overwhelms things. Okay, let's talk very briefly about tonic, if you don't mind, before we delve back into the history.
Yeah, so sure.
Tonic water traditionally is what's added to a gin, although it doesn't have to be. You know, you can have a martini and things like that. But why tonic water?
This also dates back to a few hundred years back, and the British were out and about. When getting to areas with malaria, they would drink quinine, and not by any means close to tonic as we know it today. And the tonic is flavored with quinine, which gives the bitterness.
Yeah.
And this would help to prevent the mosquitoes to bite. But this was super, super, super bitter. So to be able to drink it, they would dilute it with gin because they would have gin on board.
Yeah. So I've tasted neat quinine. I've had a little dab of quinine and my God, it just knocks your head off. It's so bitter.
That is super, super bitter.
and so the gin and the sweetness of the tonic was basically a way of coping with the bitterness of the quinine that they needed to.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. So the original gin and tonic would be one part tonic, three parts gin. And that way, it could help it go down.
Heavens to Betsy.
Looking at it today, it's probably the other way around.
Yeah.
Me personally, I wouldn't go more than one part gin, two parts tonic, because I think going over that, you would kill the gin in there.
Absolutely. And what's your view on tonic and gin? Is it, I mean, generally speaking, people put too much tonic in it, or is it a useful tool for gin? Or how do you take your gin?
Yeah. So I do love cocktails. For sure, I do take a gin and tonic every now and then. It's super, super easy. Take a bottle of gin, some tonic, a little ice, and it's done. So it's basically as easy to go grabbing a beer in the fridge, but tastier. and if I do so, one part gin, maximum two parts tonic. To answer your question, do people put in too much tonic?
Yeah.
Most important thing is to drink it the way you enjoy it. It's all about your palate and your experience. So how I drink it, it's not really relevant, to be honest. Yeah. But from my experience of testing a lot of gin and a lot of tonics, I find that this is generally a good ratio.
Yeah.
And many people enjoy it there. And then you can really get all of those flavors from the gin, because the tonic also helps to lift up some of the flavors, especially with the carbonation helps to lift up. And you can see people drinking gin and soda for the same purpose. You dilute it down and you get the carbonation to lift up some of the aromas and flavors.
Makes a lot of sense. Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out our series on CBD, cannabidiol, asking what future it has in the food and drink sector. Just go to foodmatterslive.com and search CBD. And now back to the chat. Okay, let's get back to the history now, because we've been drifting a little bit into my drinking session. So we started in Holland. What happens when gin comes to England after we noticed the Dutch soldiers drinking it? How did it start over here?
So it's William of Orange, who is really the man who took Geneva or the juniper spirit into the UK, another Dutch in the story here, obviously.
They're always at it, aren't they? They're always the innovators. It's so annoying. They're so good at it.
And he wants to take his Geneva with him, obviously. So start distilling in the UK. From there on, it grew in popularity. And there were many factors looking into why it grew so rapidly. I mean, one thing, obviously, is water quality at the time. You couldn't really drink the water because you got sick from it. So you wanted something with alcohol in it. So you would have the beer or the brandy, or now the gin. But taxes at the time were playing a huge role in this, because many of these products were heavily taxed, while gin wasn't. Because the tax wasn't on the alcohol itself, it was on the style of the alcohol. So making gin very, very cheap.
Yeah.
So if you would go have a pint of beer, you would spend more money than you would for a pint of gin.
Stop it. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. And obviously this helps to a huge consumption of a higher ABV drink, even though that most likely the gin at the time were lower ABV than we're seeing today, but still significantly higher than the beer.
And this led to the gin craze. So what were the gin craze years?
So the gin craze years starts in 1695 and goes on into the first half of the 18th century. Here is where you see all of these gin parlors or gin palaces popping up. Obviously the numbers differs a little bit when you look at it, but at least 15,000 gin parlors were active at the time.
Wow.
So you could also see many workers having gin as a part of their wages instead of taking the money straight up.
That's the way to keep them down, isn't it? Yeah, keep them drunk and happy and they'll do exactly what you say. Yeah. And then, of course, it became more and more notorious. There's obviously the famous Hogarth paintings. Can you talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, so these are two paintings that should be viewed side by side, obviously.
Yep.
The one depicting Beer Street and the other depicting Gin Lane.
Yep.
So looking into Beer Street, you will find people are happy, enjoying themselves, singing, dancing, looking over into Gin Lane on the opposite. Here you will find pregnant women drinking gin. You would see corpses lying in the gutter, being rolled out, wheelbarrows. There's one woman sitting drinking gin, dropping her small child.
Yeah, which is falling down the steps, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And this is propaganda, really.
Yeah.
And this is wanting people to start drinking more beer and less of the mother's ruin.
And why was that?
At the times, you're seeing gin acts being introduced in the UK. This is where you start putting taxes and licenses on selling gin. A license at the time, if I'm not mistaken, was £50. And £50 at this time, that is a lot of money.
That's a huge amount of money, isn't it? Yeah.
That's a huge amount of money. So basically, it was impossible to get your hands on these sort of licenses. And by no means could these 15,000 gin parlors get it. So there were very few places where you can find your gin. And this is where you also see a start of illegal serving of the gin.
It's basically our version of prohibition, isn't it?
Yes.
Effectively
for sure.
Ban it by making it too expensive. Yes. And ain't nobody going to stop drinking it. It's just going to create different types of problems.
Exactly. So one very famous and that you still see today on many bottles, and especially a style of gin, which is the old Tom style. You see depictions of cats.
Yeah.
And this dates back to this very era where you would have a wooden cat outside of the pubs. You could put a penny in the cat's mouth and the bartender on the other side of the wall would pour gin through a tube hidden in the paw of the cat to not be seen serving this illegal beverage. And many have said that this is the first ever vending machine. So it was used for serving gin.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
So that is also, yet again, then why you can see cats depicted on gin bottles, and especially on the old Tom style, which is a little sweeter than the dry gin that we also see.
Yeah. And what's interesting about this is it gives gin that sort of slightly rebellious feel to it, that it has a naughtiness, and that to carry on is a sort of a mark of independence, which is obviously part of what's great about Britain and what's awful about Britain as well. And that sense of being a rebel, I think, is kind of fundamental to a lot of these things that we enjoy. So from an industry point of view, what are the innovations that really helped gin to move on and become much more important?
So the most important thing is the column still, which is a way of purifying the alcohol to help to move on later to the dry gin that we most commonly see today. That's in the 18th century. And you start in 19th century to see dry gin coming on market.
And what does that mean? What does dry gin mean? I know it's on the label of pretty much every gin, but I don't know why it's dry or what would be a wet gin.
So very good question. Obviously, looking again at definitions, you would see three main types of gin. So we'll have the compound gin, mm-hmm. Which is basically an alcohol mixed with essences. Or for that matter, looking back early on, a gin soaked in botanicals. Then you have the distilled gin, which demands you to have an actual still where you have alcohol and botanicals in the still while distilling.
Okay.
But you're also allowed post-distillation to add different essences or infusions, for that matter, to alter or improve the flavors and aromas. And then lastly, you have the London gin or London dry gin, which is only real botanicals in the still while distilling, and you're not allowed to add anything post-distillation apart from water or neutral alcohol.
So
that's what makes it a dry gin.
Yeah, and is that technically complex to just do it in the still?
Not necessarily. You get what you get. You can't really do much with it, obviously. Then the flavors that are in there, that's what you're going to get. So to be able to adjust or add post-distillation could probably save a few batches.
Yeah.
When we know our process, when we know our recipe and how to take care of the botanicals, we get it right most of the time.
Yeah. So Johan, how often have you had to ditch a batch of gin because it didn't quite work?
So that's not very often at all. It has happened a few times. One time comes to mind where our juniper load was bad and we didn't notice on beforehand. So it's not until after we noticed that this tastes like garbage.
No, and so it comes out and literally there is nothing you can do to rectify it because you're not allowed to.
At that time, there's nothing to do.
Yeah.
Then we just discard it.
Ooh, and how much did you have to discard it in one batch?
So we have three stills, but two sizes. So our first still is a 250-liter copper still, and our two larger stills are 1,000 liters.
Yeah.
So that gives a yield ranging from around 400 or 500 bottles to 1,800, 2,000 bottles.
And which one had the bad batch?
The bad batch was the small one, fortunately. Oh,
thank God for that. Actually, just one extra little question about that. How long does it take to distill a batch?
Looking at our process, we start off with a maceration. Meaning we fill up the still with alcohol, we dilute it down with water from our own well. Then we add the first botanicals in the still. First going in the still, in our case, are juniper and coriander seeds. Juniper, yet again, the fundamentals for gin. Coriander seeds, also a super common botanical looking into gin distilling. You would see most distilleries using coriander seeds as well. And by no means to mix up with coriander leaves, which are very different in flavors.
Yeah.
The seeds are very peppery, almost citrusy, and
yes.
A little fruity. Yeah. And then at this time, we heat up the still. Our stills are steam powered, so we let this temperature take it up to just under 60 degrees Celsius, which is below the boiling point of alcohol or ethanol. And then we turn it off. We let it rest for 18 hours overnight. And the morning after, we add the remaining botanicals.
Yeah.
So the most of our gins use meadowsweet, cassia bark, black pepper, vanilla, lingonberries, and fresh lemon peel, all organic. So those botanicals goes in together with the alcohol and the juniper and the coriander. Yet again, fire up the still. And now the still runs for around 5 hours, if we're looking at the bigger ones, the 1,000-liter ones. So that gives us about 24 hours from start to end for a batch. And then we let it sit on steel tanks. Technically, yeah. It is done, but letting it sit on steel tanks helps settle all the flavors and the aromas.
And does it change in the bottle?
Very little. I mean, if you have an unopened bottle, then you can let it sit for a long, long time without in any huge way impact the flavors and the aromas.
And is there any point in storing it and you know buying a 100-year-old bottle of gin? Would you get any other flavor from it?
I mean, you see some discussions about this, obviously, and you see collectors and nerds, if you like, who try to get their hands on older bottles and see to try to figure this out, how it alters. And it does alter slightly, obviously, especially if you're looking at that sort of time range, 100 years, looking at 1 or 2 years, that's negligible. Yeah, maybe there is a point in buying a 100-year-old bottle. I would, if I could.
Okay, we've got different types of gin today, various sort of varieties and different tools. Now, you talked about the three main methods of production, but what else are the variables that people use and what different styles of gin does that create?
So looking at the styles that we see today, apart from these levels done, you would see the Old Tom that we talked about a little bit, which being a sweeter style and more botanically forward, especially floral in flavor profile, often said to be the link between Geneva and modern Ryan, because this is where it starts out. This is what you can produce prior to having the column still.
And would that be a compound gin?
No, not necessarily. It could be also be a distilled gin, but since it's mostly sweetened post-distillation, you wouldn't get to a dry gin. You would see some making a London dry gin and calling it an Old Tom. Yet again, there are discussions about how should a Old Tom actually be.
The message boards are alive with that one.
So different interpretations of the style of Old Tom. But most of them would be either compound or distilled.
Okay. And any other styles?
By tradition, you would find also the Navy Strength gin, which is a higher ABV gin. And that's really the definition of it being at 57% ABV or 100% proof. And it comes back to the British Royal Navy having gin on board.
Drink-fueled Navy, certainly. That and rum, wasn't it?
Yeah, that and rum. Some say that the officers were drinking the gin and the rest of the crew were drinking rum. I think the most logical idea here is that you would have gin on board while going out from the UK and rum on board coming home.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But the issue, apart from the drinking maybe, was if the bottles broke in storage and you would wet the gunpowder, then the gunpowder wouldn't ignite unless you had a higher ABV, 100% proof spirit. At this stage, the gunpowder would still ignite. So basically, the style of Navy Strength is all about being able to have a drink and fire the cannons at the same time.
That is brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. Makes sense.
Obviously, you get a bit more heat in these gins. Alcohol carries a lot of flavors and aroma. In our case, our dry gin and our Navy Strength gin are the same recipe, only difference being water. Less water, more alcohol in the Navy Strength, giving it much more peppery notes, lifting up the juniper, more spicy. So very different to experience, even though they're exactly the same recipe to start off with.
And any other styles as well?
Later years, we've been seeing more and more of pink gin and flavored gins. And pink gin has no tradition, really. This is a marketing gimmick coming up the later years, often sweetened. Very often you see not so juniper predominant, tending to be lower in ABV as well. And the coloring itself doesn't necessarily carry any flavor. I mean, often it is colored with food colorings. So that's only an appearance thing. And flavored gins being basically the same thing. I mean, I oppose to call it flavored gin because all gin has to be flavored by definition. That is the actual definition of gin. And often what it really is that it's flavored post-distillation. I mean, it's infusions. And looking at styles, traditional styles, you have the slow gin, which is its own style of gin or slow gin, where you have a gin and you infuse it with slow berries.
Yeah. I've got some on the go. I just cracked actually last year's one a couple of nights ago, and it's a corker. It's great.
Yeah. Slow gin is fantastic.
Nice bitterness to it. Yeah.
And often you've seen British making their own slow gin. So it's said to be that you should harvest after the first night of frosts, and you let it sit with gin, and then until Christmas, your slow gin is ready to be served, and sweetened. It has to be sweetened at a minimum of 100 grams per liter to be called a slow gin.
Yeah, because it's quite bitter.
It is quite bitter. Yeah, yeah.
My one, I once left one for 3 years, and I left it in there, and my God, it was so bitter. I literally had to just throw it away.
And you should add sugar. If you add sugar, you take away the bitterness, and it's still drinkable. Very, very nice. Yeah, I love slow gin.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, it's great stuff. Okay, now let's move on to the 20th century. So there are, you know, in the 40s and 50s, there was very much an association with, you know, international travel. It was very middle class. There was a bit of a colonial message to it as well. And it became, certainly for the British, very much a middle class tradition, I think. In the 60s, you know, you get the sort of James Bondification of gin as well. Lots of, you know, the martini drinking. Now, what are your views on all of this shift? How was it promoted and how was it consumed as a sort of social trend?
As we've been into, gin sales were going down. So my guess is that they were trying to do everything they could to try to gain back gin drinking and trying to stay on top.
So throwing glamour at the problem.
Yeah, for sure. Trying to stay on top on what is people's interest right now, obviously. Looking at Sweden, when I grew up and prior to that as well, it was only old men who drank gin. And it was the martini drinkers.
Really?
And I know that in UK, it's more of a ladies' drink, or has been, at least. I mean, you have the Queen being in the forefront there. not sure if it's true, but it's said that she drinks at least one glass of gin a day.
I'd like to think it is true.
I hope so.
And then in recent years, gin's had a real renaissance, hasn't it? And,
You
know, there were hundreds. I mean, your distillery, you know, over the last 10 years, I think that, you know, it's certainly in the UK, everyone seemed to be coming up with the gin. And that was really exciting. But what's happening now? Because that was 10 years ago, massive explosion. Have we hit peak gin and now that there'll be a whittling down of the companies and only the best ones will survive? What's your view on the current state of the market?
The market is saturated, oversaturated. It's a very heavy competition, and you continue to see new distilleries releasing gins all the time. It is absolutely crazy to keep track of the market right now. And it varies, of course, around the world. Looking at Sweden, I would say by no means have we hit peak gin. Looking at the UK, yeah, maybe you're getting closer over there. And I think also the last couple of years of the pandemic has taken its toll in many markets, being heavier on the on-premise parts, while Sweden is a more off-premise leaning market. So these things also put into to effect of how it's been over the last years. But eventually, obviously, we will come to a point where some distilleries have to stop releasing new gins all of the time, and they won't survive. I think, and also hope a little bit, that we will start to come back more to the roots of what gin is, because we're seeing many of these very modern takes on gin with flavored gins, pink gins, and these things that leans away from the juniper predominance and the classic profile of a gin. And looking into the boom as well, if we're taking a bit later than the 50s, 60s we're talking about, I would say Bombay is one of the keys to starting the boom. They started in 86 and were the first modern, if you like, gin distillery, even though if they have a, to my palate, a very traditional profile to it. Then we see 99, Hendrix comes along. And 2000, Tanqueray releases their number 10 to be in the game, obviously, to have something to compete with. And then in 09, this is where it really starts to get interesting, because this is where Sipsmith launches. And they are the first craft distillery in London because of a old legislation, meaning that you weren't allowed to distill on stills smaller than 1,800 liters. And then eventually they got the permit for their 300 liter still, which obviously opened up to smaller distilleries starting. And you see the same type of legislation in many countries. In Sweden, we had a manufacturing monopoly until we entered the EU. So until that stage, only the state were allowed to make alcohol of any type in Sweden. So for us, the EU was something that opened up to have the possibility to even start a distillery or a brewery here.
And so this comes to down to the my final couple of questions, really. So for you are a craft distiller.
Yep.
How do you see yourselves weathering the contraction of the market? What are the things that are going to keep you going and keep you growing?
So I think I have to come back to one of the first questions you asked me, and that is to keep consistency and to not jump onto every new single trend coming along and trying to...
You mean you don't have a pink version? Is that what you're saying?
No, we don't have the pink version. actually, we do have a gin called Herno Pink Bottle Gin, which is a pink bottle, but a clear liquid. It's a real London dry in there. We have more juniper in that than any other gin that we ever made, just to make the statement clear. And on the bottle, you can read, this is not a cocktail. Pink gin is a cocktail. This is a pink bottle of gin.
Yeah.
And pink gin being a classic cocktail with gin and bitters, often drunk in the British Navy. So we don't have that. We do have a dry gin. We have an Old Tom. We have a Navy. We have a cast aged on juniper wood, which is obviously slightly contemporary leaning. And then we have a slow gin. And on top of that, we have vintage limited releases editions. But this is the fundament of our product range. So keep doing those.
So to sort of keep it calm and consistent. And as you say, bring out special editions, but maybe not have loads of them going all the time. You do it for a certain amount of time and then retract again.
Yeah, exactly. That's the strategy we have been working with, and I still believe strongly in it. Unfortunately, many of the very new distillers, they will most likely, some of them at least, go under when the gin boom continues.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so my last question is that if I wanted to make my own gin, now you can get these tiny little stills on eBay and get them imported from China. Is this a good idea, or am I going to blow my house up? And if not, how would I go about making my own tiny batch gin?
Doing a bathtub or a compound gin is probably the easiest way. I mean, to infuse botanicals in a neutral alcohol. Try to get as high ABV as possible. It extracts more flavors. To be able to really perfect it, I think still is a good idea. And disclaimer, here in Sweden, it's illegal to have your own still at home. I'm not sure about
it. It is here as well, I think. So, but just hypothetically.
Hypothetically, I think there's a low chance that you will blow your head off.
Excellent. Well, that's good.
I mean, you have to take care of the cooling. That's the important part, to cool it off so you don't get vapor coming out of the still.
Excellent. And where do I get my juniper from? Where does most juniper come from?
Most juniper comes from South Europe. Ours come from Macedonia, but you see many of it in Bulgaria as well. So most of the juniper to the gin distillers around the world comes from that area.
Okay, well, I'm going to have a go. I'm not going to have a go. I promise you I won't have a go, but we might have to have a tasting, you know, a little private tasting at some point in the near future.
Yeah, for sure. Excellent. For sure. Would love to.
Johan Wester, thank you so much for joining me. That was absolutely brilliant and gave us some huge depth to understand the gin market.
Thank you so much, Stefan. Thank you for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Table Talk. If you did, there are plenty more at foodmatterslive.com. For example, if you go to the site and search The History of Tea, you'll find the episode where we look into the past of one of the world's most popular drinks. It's a whirlwind tour from ancient China to kombucha with the author of the World Tea Encyclopedia, Will Battle. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.